I'm Dr. Howie Jacobson, and this is the Plant Yourself Podcast. Each week, I bring you a conversation with someone who's making a positive difference in the world. And for my day job, I help leaders and their teams master their mindsets so they can achieve great things. To find out more, check out the Mindset Mastery Memo, my Substack newsletter. You can find it at plantyourself.com/memo. And now, today's show. I'm Dr. Howie Jacobson, and this is the Plant Yourself Podcast. Each week, I bring you a conversation with someone who's making a positive difference in the world. And for my day job, I help leaders and their teams master their mindsets so they can achieve great things. To find out more, check out the Mindset Mastery Memo, my Substack newsletter. You can find it at plantyourself.com/memo. And now, today's show.
Hey, this is Howard Jacobson. Welcome to the Plant Yourself Podcast. My guests today are Adam Aronovitz and Alyssa Bilfield, the co-founders of The Cookbook Project, which is found on the web at thecookbookproject.org. Welcome, Adam and Alyssa.
Thanks, Howard. We're thrilled to be here.
Yeah. So let's start with the basics. What is The Cookbook Project? Just a brief description to orient our listeners.
Sure. So the Cookbook Project, we're a nonprofit organization, and we're a food literacy and cooking education organization. So we work with communities around the world, and we train community leaders, educators, healthcare providers, interested volunteers. We train a lot of health counselors as well to be able to lead food literacy and cooking education programs with either youth or adults in their community.
Gotcha. And this is global.
It's global. We've trained at this stage, we're zeroing in on 500 food literacy educators in 35 U.S. states and more than 20 countries. And Alyssa and I have led field projects extensively all over Asia and parts of Africa and the Caribbean.
Wow. So tell me, how did the idea for this come about, that you guys were gonna help share food literacy in the U.S. and around the world?
Well, I think it's really a combination of both me and Adam's areas of expertise and also our interest. Adam comes to the Cookbook Project with many years of experience as an experiential educator and also an educator in the formal school system in the Boston Public Schools. And my background is actually in environmental sustainability. So I'm really concerned with developing environmental consciousness through what we eat every day. So the fact that every day, you know, three times a day if we're lucky, we have the opportunity to choose what we eat, and whatever we choose to buy, that makes an impact not only on our health, but also on the health of our local community and also on the sustainability of the environment. So we really felt passionately about reconnecting people back to their traditional and family-based food cultures and to use that as a really strong foundation for teaching healthy, sustainable, and budget-friendly cooking.
Mm-hmm. So, go ahead, Howard.
No, go ahead. Keep going.
And I was going to say, you know, I spent many years teaching in the Boston Public Schools, and I really found that my students, many of whom were arriving from other countries, as they started to adapt to the standard American diet, you know, not only were there unwanted physical changes, you know, leading to obesity, but their ability to focus in the classroom, you know, even if their English skills were improving, their test scores were dropping, and we started to have a lot of kids that were being put on ADHD medication based on these changes that were happening in the classroom. And from what I saw, it was really a big change in the diet that were causing a lot of these issues. And so wanted to create a curriculum that could address these changes because it was not being addressed in the public school system at that time.
So you saw kids, and I'm assuming that, a number of these kids were immigrants who didn't have a lot of money.
Yeah, and so what's interesting is if they're coming from Latin America, for example, the cheapest foods in Latin America were higher quality whole grains. They're eating a lot of plant-based protein. They're eating a lot of local fresh fruits and vegetables. And as soon as they got to the United States, all of a sudden the cheapest and most affordable foods are at least for what was being advertised to them were really highly processed foods and lots of white grains. And this was something that had a really negative impact on them.
Mm. And did you find that there was a awareness in the communities that their kids were concentrating less, or did they just put it down to becoming Americanized?
So this is really coming from teachers struggling with inability to focus, and teachers are under a lot of pressure to deliver ever increasing test scores, and so really found that for kids that were not succeeding and that they were headed on a negative trajectory, this was the intervention that was being suggested, and in some cases, strongly suggested to families.
So your work in getting people to eat better grew out of these communities and these students?
The original idea came out of these experiences because the issues weren't being addressed. There were health educators that would come into the schools, but it was just, it happened for an hour or two. It was people that the children had no connection with. So we really worked to develop a curriculum that we would be able to test for, quite a while to make sure that this is something that was really effective, and then be able to offer this curriculum to people that are already connected to these youth groups, so that they're really key informants and they're going to have a lasting impact on the youth they work with.
Mm. Okay. And Alyssa, so you said your background is environmental sustainability. I know a lot of people in environmental sustainability whose attention is focused almost entirely on fossil fuels and don't give a thought to food. How did you make that connection?
Well, that's a great question. I think I've always really loved food, and I've always really loved cooking. Although I grew up in the Midwest in a pretty standard Midwestern family, from the time I was really young, I was always interested in animal rights and vegetarianism, and also veganism to a certain extent. And so that was always part of what I considered when I sat down at the table. And when I was working for the state government in Boston, just like you said, I was doing a lot of, energy focused policy that really looked at building impact and transportation impact. But I myself was getting more involved in the local food justice movement. And, as an environmentalist doing research about the impact that our food choices have on the environment, I really saw very definitively that the organizations who were doing that type of work, like the UN Food and Agriculture Organization, were finding incredible, I think about a third of the greenhouse gas impact globally that we have actually comes from the agriculture industry. And part of that's transportation, but part of that's also really the meat and dairy industry and, the resources that go into producing food out of those two industrial systems. So I really saw that we have a real opportunity in our daily lives to mitigate that, to use an environmental term, to mitigate our own personal impact on the environment through our food choices.
Hmm. And so how did you guys meet and give birth to this nonprofit?
So we actually met on a program called Semester at Sea, which is a study abroad program for university students. It's a quite incredible program. You actually live on a ship. You study on the ship, and then you have opportunities to take your coursework into the field as you circumnavigate the globe. So Alyssa and I met on this program, and we were both pretty young when I was 21 and Alyssa was 20, and through those experiences we really started to see what were the major issues that were happening across the world. What was the impact of Western systems in the developing world, And I think this has always been at the forefront, you know, that experience is at the forefront of you know, our planning and our career paths, which eventually led to really creating a project that we both feel really hits at the roots of many of the issues that we see in the world today, the health disparity issues, environmental issues. You know, as Alyssa was saying before, I think in terms of environmental sustainability, especially for urban youth have no connection to the environment. They really don't have the opportunity to interact with the natural world. But food is really there. It's the way that we can draw that connection. When they start to understand that food does come from the earth and that we need a healthy earth to provide food for us, we found that students are much more engaged and eager to start to incorporate some positive changes in their own life that are also going to affect their, you know, the global society.
Gotcha. So here's what I find myself wondering. So one of you was a school teacher. The other was working for state government. I don't mean to make this an embarrassing question. I don't know if either of you are, you know, trust fund children, but to form a nonprofit that's going to do significant work often requires significant funding. What made you guys think you could put together something and get it funded and create something big? Because so many people I know have the same thoughts and impulses as you, but they don't do it. They don't do what you did. What was the ingredient that led you to actually create something and fund it?
Well, I think that's a great question. So something that did happen when we were living and working in the Boston area and both, you know, making, you know, relatively decent salaries at that point. The Boston Public Schools actually compensate teachers very well compared to most school districts. And so we were able to save quite a bit of money during that time. And we left to take a year off to travel and volunteer across Asia. And while we were doing that, the roots of the organization had started to sprout, but it wasn't a formal organization or a concept at that point. And as we were volunteering with different organizations around the world, we realized what we were working on is something that could be of benefit to everyone. So we started piloting the project while traveling in Asia. You know, we were really just doing this out of our backpacks at first. It didn't require, you know, we could do a full week-long project for less than $50, with ingredients being very inexpensive in that part of the world. So for the first 4 years or 3.5 years of the organization, significant funding really wasn't an issue. And it's only as we recently returned to the U.S. full-time this summer to really focus on building the domestic food literacy initiative in, starting in Boston and New Orleans. And that's been, you know, now we're at the stage where funding is essential to maintaining the growth trajectory of the organization.
Gotcha.
Yeah, but yeah, a whole lot of bootstrapping those first few years. And, you know, Alyssa and I, we definitely made a lot of personal sacrifices to be able to see this happen. You know, but I do think that it's not often that something comes together that really has the potential to make a gigantic impact in the world, and it wasn't something that we were willing to see sort of just flutter away before, you know, really putting everything we could into it.
So describe to me one of the most sort of exciting or interesting or impactful projects that you've done, either in the U.S. or anywhere in the world. What kind of postcard comes to mind for you?
Okay, so there one project that's coming to some, and I'm actually surprised that this is the project that's coming to mind, but there was a project we did last fall at the Nepal Orphans Home. So it's a home outside of Kathmandu. They rescue young women and young boys that have been part of the Komari system, which is basically a system where children are sold, mostly girls at the age of 7, into basically indentured servitude. It's unfortunately a very common practice in parts of rural western Nepal. And so these children are rescued and brought to Kathmandu. And so we had a relationship with this organization for quite a while, and we were working with some of the older girls there. I would say ages 14 to 20 or so, and we were doing an adapted food literacy educator training program with them. So that was, it was a really amazing program because they started to understand that some of these village foods that they always thought were foods for poor people were actually some of the healthiest foods on earth, and some of the foods that people in the West are paying a lot of money to be able to eat. Lucy, what was the name of that one, that one green fish?
The green fish.
That's, that one village dish, that fermented village dish.
Oh, Gundruk.
Yeah, Gundruk. This dish, Gundruk, it's a really amazing dish. Alyssa could say a little bit more about it.
So the Nepalese have a really complex and very rich system of food preservation. So they do a lot of natural fermenting and pickling, but they also do a lot of drying. Well, the Gundruk is actually, it's pickled or like lacto fermented greens that are then dried and stored. So it has a really, kind of almost like a seaweed or jewels, if anyone's ever had that. It's got like a really salty, umami kind of flavor to it. But the great thing about it is, you know, when you have a bumper crop of spinach, it's a really great way to preserve it. So they do it with a lot of other mustard greens and things like that. It gets dried in the sun. You know, all the women in the village get together to do this over a couple of days. And then it's able to be preserved and used throughout the year to add nutrition in, non-harvest season.
Mm-hmm. But anyway, so that's just one example of one dish that we highlighted that in a lot of different fermentation practices to demonstrate the wisdom of traditional Nepali food culture at a time when the children there, although they're not able to afford it, you know, dreaming that one day they'll be able to afford to go to the KFC that just opened up in Kathmandu. That's like seen as a growing status symbol, which is strange in a country where vegetarianism still is very common. And, what really happened out of this project that was so amazing was at the end of the project, along with some of the leaders, we met with the leadership for the organization. And on a meal-by-meal basis, we came up with solutions for what was currently being provided and what could be provided at an even lower cost with greater health. And that included transitioning from white rice to 50-50 brown rice and white rice health. Full brown rice, which is from our last conversation with them, is what they're serving now, and moving away from for snack, they were which actually is lunch. It was either donuts or it was ramen noodles that they were just eating raw. Mm. And so started working on this idea to make a bulk meal to provide that to the youth that are part of this organization, but also to sell at a very low cost. Homemade prepared lunches to the other, families of the other students that are coming to the school. So that was, that was one project that things really came together where there was a very measurable long-term impact to the community.
And are you seeing the same effects of a better diet on these young girls in Kathmandu as you did in the Latin American immigrants to the Boston area? Like, do they focus better, have more, passion and productivity? Like, what do you see in terms of their affect and behavior that tells you you're on the right track?
That's a great question. And, this a longitudinal study in Nepal where our organization is at this point is not, it's something that's very difficult for us to carry out without really a research budget. What we have found, it's more anecdotal for a lot of our international projects, is that the women are stepping into a leadership role in terms of cooking, that they've been really excited to be able to cook for the younger children that are part of the community, and really feeling an increased appreciation for their traditional food culture and understanding of some of the dangers of the standard American diet that's been, heavily advertised in Nepal and other parts of the world.
And I think in terms of the projects that we do in the United States, all of the participants are gaining skills and a lot of knowledge, but I think a really important aspect of the cooking programming is building self-efficacy or self-confidence. So So all these participants, whether it's elementary school, middle school, or high school, you know, it's sort of the example of the small wins. When they're able to cook a meal, when they're able to prepare something for the first time and then eat it and it tastes delicious or recreate that at home with their families, it really builds a lot of self-confidence, and that transfers over into other areas of their life.
Mm. So I have a question that feels complicated to me, and I want to make sure I ask it in a useful way. But one of the things I was thinking about when I was preparing for this interview and looking at your website is, so I imagining like what it's like for a couple of, you know, middle class American whites to go around the world, teach people how to eat. And, you know, there's, 'cause there's a lot of health education that is very sort of top down and insensitive. And I know that you guys think long and hard about, you know, how to empower communities. But is there a way that you guys being representatives of sort of wealthy corporate industrialized America actually had an advantage in working with some of these populations in destigmatizing their own cuisines?
That's a really great question, and we've thought about that too. I'm going to answer the first part of that, and I think Adam will probably jump into the second. I think our curriculum, because it's grown out of the experiential education philosophy, it's really less of a pedagogical system in which Adam and I go and teach people the right way to eat. It's actually more of a curriculum in which Adam and I facilitate an experience for a group of people to reconnect to the wisdom of their own food culture traditions. And sometimes we're working with groups where that tradition is the same. And sometimes, you know, in the case of the U.S., we're working with groups that are coming from a wide variety of backgrounds. So it's really more of us as an organization providing a forum for people to reconnect to traditional foods, and, you know, to gain skills or to return to cooking methods that maybe their families won't know about.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, and the first activity that we do, which is really why we're called the Cook Project, is each participant makes a food culture recipe, which is a mini cookbook that highlights just a dish that they want to share from their family tradition, from their heritage. And so that's really what we use as a lens for the rest of the program, is to look at that and start to look at some of the traditional ways that dish was cooked, how to make it a little bit healthier. And I think that's something that is really valuable, you know, for us coming and representing the West is, you know, for example, if we're working in Vietnam, for the youth there to see that Americans actually love Vietnamese food, that it's not, you know, they've developed an inferiority complex about their own food because all of the advertising that they see is for pizza, fried chicken, hamburgers, you know, all these
soda,
right? All these, and so they really think that in the West, this is what successful and very intelligent people are consuming. And for them to understand that actually, it's pretty much the opposite, that people in the U.S., especially people that have been, you know, lucky enough to have access to really great information about healthy eating, are really flocking towards those traditional types of food in droves and really bringing health back into the kitchen.
Mm. When you travel around the world, do you get a sense that people see the link between diet and maybe how their own lifestyles have changed from being sort of, you know, relatively autonomous subsistence farmers to losing their lands to, you know, dessert crops and coffee and tea and sugar or whatever else? Are people making sort of geopolitical and economic connections to the way food has changed?
Definitely. And I think we've even been both surprised and impressed with, you know, some of the rural communities we work with, especially in Africa, that are dealing with this kind of transition into a more urbanized world. You know, it's been interesting to talk with people, especially the folks, you know, the generation who we've often worked with when we've done leadership training, just to talk to them about, you know, the foods that their parents ate and the foods that their kids are now eating. and what's different about that has been super interesting.
So what happens when people get the message? Because it occurred to me you're talking about putting women in leadership positions, recreating appreciation of their traditional cultures, kind of destabilizing their worship of the West. You guys are pretty subversive. what ripple effects, do you see anecdotally when people start to put two and two together?
I mean, what our goal is really is to get people to feel equipped with the tools to be able to provide healthy food for themselves that's based on tradition and not a newly introduced shift in media and culture that's really come up over the last, few decades. Because we've definitely seen in the United States that there's been a significant gap in cooking competency over the last couple of generations. And it's had a disastrous effect on public health in the United States with the growing obesity and diabetes epidemic. And it's something that, the trajectory is the same all over the world. They're at least a generation behind, but it's happening really rapidly. And so this brings up a really interesting point, because I think something that we realized over the last couple of years is these projects, and as amazing as they have been and how great they've been for each community we work with, it, in a lot of ways, it is a symptom of the standard American diet in the West and that culture that is being exported to other parts of the world. And that's really played a big role in our shift in focus to domestic programming, is to really shift the food system in the United States and really focus on actually changing the dominant food culture in domestically, so that starts eventually to be able to spread internationally. It's already happening in upper class communities internationally. We saw a lot in India that the upper class communities, especially who are most suffering from diabetes right now, they're starting to see a lot more organic stores open. They're starting to go back to vegetarian diets
and back to a lot of their traditional grains, mm-hmm. aside from white rice.
There's a big movement in India by an amazing organization called Sharan. She's a doctor who works with patients exclusively using plant-based diets, and she's seen a huge reversal in diabetes and many other issues, and that's something that's growing a lot in India. So we're really now working to accelerate that process here domestically so that we can see it spread across the world.
That's funny, because I buy a lot of my spices and pulses at this local Indian grocery store, and for the first time I went in last week, they had a line of organic products.
Oh, interesting.
Which is like Mantra 24, which is so weird to see. Like, the stuff is cheap and it's really healthy, but there was never, in my experience, that sort of consciousness around different grades. I assumed it was just for import to the U.S., but it sounds like it's a growing consciousness.
It's an Indian brand.
Yeah.
Yes, an Indian brand. And what's interesting, we did some digging around when we were in India working on a project in the South, and we actually found through a local organic shop that actually the suppliers of those organic brands, their initial market is the United States, although it gets rebranded under different companies that export it to the U.S. But that brand that you saw in the Indian grocery store, Mantra, there's a couple other ones, are specifically, those same, farmers and corporations, but producing for the Indian market. So we're really hopeful when we see things like that, and we see, consciousness in other countries, as Adam was saying, especially amongst the rising middle class, start to focus on those types of issues.
That's great. And it feels good to me to hear, because I can get so caught up in just looking at, the U.S. environment and political culture and, industry stranglehold on policy, to realize that there's a lot more people in the world than just us.
Exactly. Mm-hmm.
But we do have the choices that we make here in the United States and the markets that we create as consumers. Have a very, very, very strong ripple effect across the world. It does take some time for those waves to reach some of the far off destinations. But as consumers, and I'm sure a lot of people that are listening to this podcast, do make very conscious choices about how they spend their money and who they choose to support. And it really is important. It's going to have a very important effect on, you know, on global food culture.
So what challenges have you seen in working domestically that maybe surprised you a little bit or were harder than you thought it was going to be?
That's a great question. I think, you know, there are a lot of reasons why Adam and I ended up leading so many projects internationally. But one of them is definitely that, you know, in the United States, you really need to be very conscious about liability issues and paperwork. You know, there's a lot of signatures required to run programming. And there are a lot of those types of red tape issues that can make program planning more complicated. But we've really tried, especially over the last year, as we've been cultivating a larger number of trained food educators here in the United States to build up a number of resources for folks who do want to work in their communities in this way and to make it as easy as possible for them.
Yeah, I think another, you know, from an organizational standpoint, you know, to be able to work, to really focus our work in the U.S., you know, it does require significantly more resources for the organization to exist. So, you know, it takes quite a bit of, you know, more time than we'd like away from developing programs and for doing trainings to development and fundraising for the organization, which has been it's challenging when we know that if we spent a few more hours recruiting food literacy educators, that we could have 100 more programs happening in this year in the U.S. But we have to spend a lot of that time working on the sustainability of the organization.
Gotcha. So here's another question I'm wondering about, which is in Nepal, there's a clear difference between Gundrup and KFC. Like, nobody thinks that KFC is their traditional dish. In the U.S., in, you know, communities of color, in Latin American communities, there's a lot of food that looks like traditional food or soul food, you know, velvet cake and you know, pork stuff and pork belly, you know, and you know, like Taco Bell. That has the veneer of a traditional culture, which people can derive great pleasure from, but it's not really their traditional culture. Do you find that it's more complicated to introduce, you know, African Americans and American Latinos to their traditional healthy culture because of this confusion?
That's a really great question. It does get vastly more complicated in the United States because of just, you know, the waves of immigration and all the different, you know, types of ethnicities that are represented in this country. And so I think, you know, going back to the very first session of the Cookbook Project curriculum, the activity of the food culture recipe is where I think the rubber really hits the road and where, you know, our facilitators and Adam and I, in our own experiences, are able to really sort of get a snapshot of where the group is at that we're working with. You know, I think we really try to be, although there are a lot of general trends happening, we try to be really cognizant and present with each of the groups that we work with to all of the individuals and where they're at. So, you know, within a particular group, we might have, you know, a lot of kids from Latin America, a lot of kids, you know, who are African American or even, you know, first generation from West Africa coming to the country, and they may or may not actually have a strong connection to a particular food culture. And we might get, you know, a recipe that is like a bag of hot chips and a Coca-Cola. You know, what do we do with that as facilitators? And so we really try to positively equip our participants with the critical thinking skills to tell the difference between something that appears to be a food and something that really is a food.
So, when you work with, I mean, a lot of these foods are very, you know, emotionally based for people. When I talk to, you know, I don't even have to talk to people. If I just go out with a group of people, somebody will notice that I'm eating a certain way, and despite my best conscious efforts, people can get defensive about that, about, you know, that somehow I'm I represent a threat to their self-esteem. Do you get that either with the youth you work with, or with adults, or the people that who are, you know, the gatekeepers who are going to let you in or not, that somehow you're attacking their very personal food choices?
It's another great question. And I think what we've, so there's a couple different ways that I'd like to approach this. One is that, you know, we're not trying to attack anything. You know, we're never telling youth, don't eat this, don't eat that. But just, you know, we're about food literacy. And, you know, by definition, that means understanding the impact our food choices have on ourselves, our community, and the environment. So when we're working with a youth group, for example, you know, they're already maybe have an idea that eating, fried chicken and cake, is not the best way to start their day. So that's already an idea they have. But a lot of people, you know, are willing to do things. You know, it's very clear there's a lot of people that know that smoking cigarettes is not very good for them, but they do it anyway. With the idea that, you know, it's their own life and they're only hurting themselves. But when communities start to understand that, you know, if one individual, one youth member just, you know, starts to understand the impact that choice has on his local community, you know, that, you know, if he's shopping at, you know, just an example at KFC, you know, that's taking money out of his local community, his or her local community, and sending it to, you know, wherever the corporate office is for that particular chain. And that's money that never comes back to the community. You know, it puts people out of work. It you know, hurts the, you know, local food producer market. And at the same time, when they start to understand how those food choices affect the global environment, it moves beyond just making a selfish individual choice to a choice that's going to have a negative impact, not only on themselves, but everyone that they care about and everyone even people that they haven't met before. And we found for youth, especially in those adolescent years, where being you don't want to be seen as someone that's hurtful. That concept really starts to take root and start to understand that they actually, every time that they choose to eat or they choose to, you know, start preparing food for themselves, they can make a choice that's going to have a positive impact and a positive ripple effect across the world.
And at the risk of being a little bit more subversive, I think youth, especially, you know, from middle school into high school, that particular age range, when they start to learn about food justice issues, specifically related to food corporations, they get pissed. You know, they get upset, and they're angry that they feel like they've been taken advantage of or duped by all these advertisements. And we really often see a strong reaction where they're like, "No, I'm not going to buy that. Like, I'm going to make this myself." You know, and it's really it's wonderful to see, you know, how different youth react. That, you know, that's been a common reaction, actually.
And I think one clarifying point I want to put out there, you know, we're not as an organization, we have no goal to, to destroy fast food companies and, you know, anything like that. We're really trying to create demand, you know, a greater demand, especially in communities that typically haven't demonstrated demand for healthier foods. Because, you know, the reason that food deserts exist, it's not because grocery stores, don't want to be there. It's the fact that if they go into those areas and people aren't demanding produce and shopping at an actual grocery store, those grocery stores are going to go out of business. So if we start building demand in these areas that have typically been food deserts, we're going to start to see people that want to make a fair profit go in and provide the food that these communities are going to be able to purchase and create the meals.
So how do you bridge the catch-22 gap between, you've got communities who aren't demanding healthy food, so you have no sources of healthy food in the community, then you come in and you start to create demand, but there still isn't a grocery store. It's still the 7-Eleven or the gas station convenience store. How do you support people ongoing to feed themselves once they've been, you know, educated about their options?
That's a great question. And so something that's happening, it's happening very rapidly in the United States, is better food access. That's been where the majority of funding has gone to. The vast majority of funding has gone to food access programs. you know, when I was teaching in the Boston school, Boston Public Schools, and my school, you know, they're spending many hundreds of thousands of dollars more that year to provide a healthier lunch program. But every time I picked up my kids in the cafeteria, you know, when I come in, we got my seventh graders, it would be the blueberries and the broccoli sitting untouched on the plate. And so we're finding that there's so many, you know, all these great urban garden programs, but the kids aren't eating that food. They have no idea what it is. It's not connected to their food culture. So there actually is, at this stage, a huge increase in access, at least at that level. But the demand is there. So we're really trying to build the demand. And once we can start seeing that, okay, kids are eating healthier lunches, you know, they're starting to consume these foods more, we're seeing a correlation in academic performance and ability to focus. We're seeing a positive correlation in terms of obesity and diabetes and, you know, maybe some secondary correlations like reduction in violence and, you know, increased interest in physical activity. That's when you know, the wave is really set to go. So right now, and that's why we work primarily with youth or with organizations. We train a lot of people that are working in residential organizations like healthcare for the homeless organization, in places where food is being supplied by those sites, and then just building increasing skills so that they can start taking this home. So that's one piece. The other piece is that, you know, we do something called the Sunday Gay Plan, which is a way for both youth and their families to plan out ahead of time. So if they're going to be able to make one trip to the grocery store a month and load up on a ton of whole grains and a ton of different types of plant-based protein, then they're in a position where they've got the basis for every meal already there, and that it just takes, you know, there is availability in these corner stores of, you know, limited produce and limited fruits, but if they already have the, you know, the base of whole grains and plant-based protein, they can create tasty meals with a little spice collection at an incredibly low cost per serving.
And do you find that, you know, so in the sort of upper middle class communities that I'm often communicating with, one of the big issues is time. I'm too busy. I get home at 7. I don't know how to do this. Is time an issue in these communities as well?
Yeah, time is an issue, I think, across the board, especially in the United States. You know, it's just sort of an after effect of the multitasking, hectic lifestyle that we've all kind of adopted. And so, you know, that's another reason why we created this really strategy called the Sunday Game Plan, where, you know, whatever day of the week it is that you have an hour or two where you're doing, you know, chores at home, maybe it's laundry, you're doing the bills, whatever, you set yourself up during that time period to make staples for the rest of the week. So a couple whole grains, a couple beans, you put them on the stove while you're doing other things so that, you know, you have those basics to work with throughout the week. And we found, you know, this works with, you know, AmeriCorps volunteers living on the poverty line that are just out of college. It works with the families of the participants that they serve, and it also works very well in middle to upper income neighborhoods as well.
And I'd like to piggyback on that for a second. You know, and that's another reason that we really do focus on youth, is I definitely found teaching in Boston, you know, especially with in lower-income families, you know, these parents, they're working 2, 3, sometimes 4 jobs, you know, a ton of single-parent families. They're simply not around to cook for their youth. It's not that they don't want to or they're choosing to do other things with their time. They're just trying to provide the basic necessities for survival. But youth have a lot of time, and that's why, you know, in a lot of ways, and especially in lower-income urban communities, some may argue that they have too much time, and that's why we're, you know, that there's a lot of, you know, gang issues developed in certain parts of the city. And so we're really trying to create, a feeling of empowerment for these youth, so that instead of, you know, their parents having to give them money so that they can go eat a meal at a fast food restaurant, that there's food at home and these kids feel empowered to be able to go home, you know, especially once you get into adolescent age. You know, we're not saying that second graders should go home and turn on the stove and start, you know, pulling out knives, but that they can actually go home and they can take a huge load off of the families while also reducing the economic burden of eating so many meals out.
Oh, that is so beautifully elegant. It reminds me of, you know, looking at these abandoned lots in inner cities and seeing them as, you know, places where crime happens, places where kids get into trouble, places where toxic chemicals are dumped, and seeing them as gardens. And you know, solving the problem with the elements of the problem. Taking, you know, seeing youth as the sources of the energy to provide the good food that is going to solve so many problems.
I really love the term "the problem is the solution," and I think that's definitely the case here. And you know, in cooking, and I think if people, you know, I'm sure a lot of people that are listening to this are probably very active in the kitchen, and there's so many benefits to cooking. You know, it's a huge confidence booster. You know, every time you actually prepare a meal, you know, it's a win. It's a great way to express artistic creativity. You know, we always think of food as edible art. You know, there's so many different components to cooking that provide benefit, you know, that can be hard to measure quantitatively, especially for youth, but it's something that is at the core of, you know, of our organization and why we do the work we do.
Great. So I'm feeling a little guilty because there's so much more work you need to do in the world. I don't want to keep taking up your time, but if people have been as inspired as I have been by this conversation, how can they find out more, get involved? What is there to do?
So that's a great question. I'm glad we had time to bring that up. So really, there's two things that people can do. One is if they're really interested in this concept and want to be a part of the movement, is to actually train with the Cookbook Project to be a food literacy educator. We work with a lot of people that are fully employed and are just interested in starting a, you know, like a parents group or volunteering at their faith-based organization or volunteering in their school to bring aspects of the Cookbook Project curriculum into their own community. We also find that, and this is an area we'd love to see a measurable increase, is for individual families to be able to use the Cookbook Project's curriculum to get their children interested and engaged in the cooking process. And I'm sure parents wouldn't be upset to hear also engaged in the cleaning process. those are two big ways. We're always, you know, really looking to expand our reach and we're, you know, on the other hand, so people can do that by going to our website, www.thecookbookproject.org. We're in the middle of a website migration, but the address will be the same. And there are opportunities on there to train with us. And we're always looking for volunteers that maybe aren't so interested in leading programming, but are interested in raising awareness about the work we do and building support for the Cookbook Project so that we can, you know, exponentially increase our programming both in the U.S. And abroad.
So you guys are still bootstrapping, looks like.
We are very much still bootstrapping. We were recently, and we're currently actually based out of New Orleans. We were selected for the Propeller Social Venture Accelerator Fellowship. So they select 15 social ventures, both for-profits and non-profits, that they see with the capacity to create
systemic change
in a few key areas. So we're working, you know, very focused right now on building the infrastructure so that that our organization has that type of reach. But yes, we're still very much bootstrapping for the next couple of years. It takes a significant amount of both data and financial records to be candidate for those huge grants that would allow us to scale up. So, you know, so right now we're really, you know, our organization's funding, I think our average donation is less than $50 at this point. So it's really, you know, smaller contributions from people that are really engaged about the issue that enable us to be able to continue doing this work.
Awesome. Well, you know, I'm a gardener, and I have to tell you that the seeds I put in the ground are quite small.
Mm-hmm. Right.
If it wasn't for them, I wouldn't be harvesting all these greens right now.
Exactly. And so we're there's a lot of those pieces. Listen, I don't come to this with a nonprofit experience. This, our goal at first wasn't to create an organization. It was just to start leading these projects. And eventually people that we met were interested in learning if they could do it and how they could do it. And so that's really how the organization came into place. And so now we're just trying to find out how we can make this as sustainable as possible and how we can really, work together. And, tagline that we've been using is, cook the change you wish to see in the world, because we really see cooking just has such a huge ripple effect. And we're thrilled to have the opportunity to do this.
Wow. Well, it has been so inspiring to talk to you guys. So I would encourage everybody, go to thecookbookproject.org. And so you can get involved just with your own family. People can get their hands on the basic curriculum and just help their own kids.
Yeah, that sounds great. And also, people feel free to email us, info@thecookbookproject.org. That ends up going right into my inbox. So, it'd be great to hear from people on the call if they have suggestions. I know there's probably a lot of people that are interested in plant-based lifestyles, and love to share how we incorporate that into our curriculum. So it'd be great to hear from listeners and work together to create a better future.
Awesome. So I hope people will listen, volunteer, donate, get inspired to do your own things, even though you don't have millions of dollars to get it started with. Adam and Alyssa, you guys are an inspiration. I'm feeling twice as energized now as I did at the beginning of the call, and I'm so glad that you're out there and that the world is being so responsive to this message that we so desperately need to spread. So thank you guys so much for taking the time to talk to me today.
Thank you so much for having us. We really appreciate the opportunity to talk with more of you.
Yeah, Howard, great being here, and thank you for offering such great questions that really challenged us and helped us to even gain a deeper understanding of, who we are, what we do, and why we do it. It's always helpful to have the forum to be able to, to really express what's happening with the organization.
Well, thank you for giving me the opportunity.
All right. All right. Have a great day. And, we'll talk to you soon.
You guys too. Take care.
Yeah.
Let's take this home with some gratitudes. First of all, thanks to Mama Earth. You have been so very, very good to me. Second, Will Ridenour donated the use of his beautiful song Sabali Dawn as the theme music for this show. You can find out more about Will's music at willridenour.com. Third, thanks to all the patrons of the Plant Yourself podcast for your financial support. You can read the names of all the patrons at any show notes at plantyourself.com. If you would like to become a patron to show your gratitude for the work I'm doing and help support it, you can do so at plantyourself.com/gift. That's G-I-F-T, all lowercase. And finally, I want to thank you, the listener, for making all of this possible, for giving me a reason to reach out to people, to have conversations, to edit, produce, publicize, all the stuff that I do is for you, so that we can continue to have conversations and continue to ripple out healing and transformation into the world.